professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When did 25 become the new 15? In an era when teenagers are more worldly, more media savvy, and more connected than any generation before them, a distressing number are failing to develop practical, financial, and emotional independence from their parents, to the extent that many college kids call home multiple times a day and move home after graduation without the skills to live successfully on their own. It's a problem my guest has seen growing for years in his clinical practice, where he specializes in working with teens, but it is not one that cannot be turned around. Joseph Allen is professor of psychology and director of clinical training at the University of Virginia. His new book, written with Claudia Worrell Allen, is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence: How We Can Help Our Teenagers Grow Up Before They Grow Old. Joe, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. It's good to be with you.
How does adolescence compare today with adolescence throughout the rest of human history?
You know, this is a truly unique period, and it's we're having our adolescents live an experiment that has never been tried before in human history in a couple of ways. One is that adolescents, until a few generations ago, used to last a microsecond. From the time when a teen developed an adult-like capacity to when some adult noticed it and said, hey, let's put that to work. And now it lasts for 10 or 15 years in some cases. We have people, you know, starting adolescence at 12 or 13 and not really feeling on their own, not being financially independent, done with their education, off living on their own until their late 20s.
Yeah, what's really shocking about that, Joe, is I remember being that age and I couldn't wait to sort of get away and be on my own. And kids today overwhelmingly report they don't want to separate from their parents.
That's right. And that's probably the most disturbing part of the change we've seen. You know, if you look even at something as simple as getting a driver's license, you know, when my generation was growing up, you turned 16 and you had two things. You got a birthday cake and you got a trip to the Motor Vehicle Administration because you applied for your license that day or you took your test that day. And now in the past 10 years, there's been a 50% increase in the number of kids who are delaying past age 16 to get their licenses. And it's not about insurance costs. It's not about accident rates. Those have all stayed pretty much the same, and accident rates, in fact, have dropped a bit. It's the kids are saying, well, mom or dad can drive me wherever I need to go. And, you know, it's kind of a hassle and a little stressful to learn to drive. And so, you know, I'll do it, but I'm not in a big hurry.
So when and how did this endless adolescence start to come into being?
Well, it's been evolving over the last few generations. And so if you talk to the grandparents of today's teens, you know, they will say, you know, their lives were quite different as teenagers even than the parents' generation was. And it's partly been a matter of education. As young people need to spend more time in school to make it in a 21st century workforce, that has extended things. But then there's been this social piece that's kicked in with parents treating their adolescents differently and with parents treating them in ways that keep them dependent for longer, in ways that they think are helping their adolescents, but that really just end up backfiring badly.
Give me some examples of things that parents do for their teenagers and 20-somethings today that they wouldn't have done a generation or two ago.
Sure. You know, there's just a whole range of things. It's pretty much all of the tasks that adults handle that we now handle for our adolescents. And it could be everything from, you know, helping them get places around town. And so the number of teens, you know, we live in a small town, Charlottesville, Virginia, where nothing is more than 2 or 3 miles away from anything else for the most part. And the number of teens who have no idea how to make it around the town on their own is just staggering. And the idea that they would walk somewhere that was 2 miles away, we get blank stares when we suggest that to teens and their parents. And that's something that adolescents routinely would walk and bike places before they got their driver's licenses, and feel a huge amount of independence and self-sufficiency as a result. We could look at other things from, you know, kids doing their own laundry to cooking to, you know, applying for a job, all tasks that we need to be able to handle to make it as adults that by 16, 17, 18, most kids were handling, and now, you know, kids are getting out of college not really having had experience with these things.
So why do we assume that they are capable of so much less than many of us, the parents of these teenagers, would have endured at the same age?
Well, you know, Chris, that's exactly the right question, I think, which is we do assume that they're capable of less, and we assume that they're just, you know, apathetic and bored and a little bit helpless and dependent, and we don't realize just how much potential there is within our teens. It's partly a phenomenon that we've created, that if you take somebody at the peak of their capacity at 15, where they're at their peak energy levels, their peak physical strength, even very close to their peak in their cognitive capacity, and you give them nothing to do and you give them no responsibility, you know, they gradually get lethargic and they get apathetic. And then we come to think, well, that's just what adolescence is about. And we talk to parents all the time. We say, well, isn't this just their brain development? Isn't this just their hormones? And you'd be tempted to think that, except that when you start to change some of these factors, you see these kids come alive and you realize, whoa, they've got far more potential than we would have ever thought.
So we cut them far too much slack because of hormones.
We cut them far too much slack because of hormones. That is, you know, a huge excuse for teens and a little bit of an excuse for parents who just don't know what to do with their teens. You know, one of the best sort of answers to the concern of is this all just hormones is actually work that's been done by anthropologists who've looked at adolescents in different societies across history. And what they found, it's two anthropologists, Alice Schlegel and Herbert Berry, that have done most of this work, what they found is that the societies that asked the most of their adolescents, that really relied on them to contribute to the society, had not only the least rates of things like juvenile delinquency, mostly they didn't even have words for juvenile delinquency. It would have made as much sense to talk about a juvenile delinquent in those societies as for us to talk about elder delinquency. You know, it's not that it couldn't happen, but it just didn't happen routinely. And that was... And we see it over and over and over again in different societies, and then it makes you realize it's not their hormones, it's the role we're putting them in. And the key part of that is that it's a role we can get them out of.
Yeah, talk for a minute about how we can help them to unlearn helplessness, especially if, you know, for a lot of families out there, they're already down that road.
Sure, and it's hard not to be down that road. That, you know, we call it the nurture paradox, that everything we tell parents from before their children are born talks about how best to nurture them, what to eat when you're expecting, what music to play them when they're in utero, and it moves right on through the lifespan. And the problem is when we get to adolescents don't need more things given to them. They need challenges. You know, they need places to spread their wings and flex their muscles and try things out and succeed and fail and develop in those ways. So it's not, we certainly don't blame parents. It's something as a society we've kind of fallen into. But there's some good ways out of it. One thing we tell parents is, you know, every parent should try and develop a little bit of an alarm bell in their head. And the bell should go off anytime they're about to do anything at all for their teenager. And they should stop then and ask themselves, wait a minute, is this something I can be teaching my teenager to do for themselves? Is this something they can be routinely doing for themselves? It could be, you know, changing a printer cartridge. It could be filling out an online application where the parent says, well, it's easier for me to just do it than to take them through all the steps they need and get the information for them. And it is easier sometimes for parents to do these things, but in the long run, it's far better and far easier in the long run if we teach our teenagers to do these things. So everything we're thinking, everything we're doing for them, we should really be stopping and thinking, these are people that are on the cusp of adulthood. And if we treat them that way and say, okay, you need to learn to do this, they'll get there a lot quicker.
You know, what's so interesting about that, those examples, Joe, is I think about, you know, when you have a two-year-old, it is much easier to feed them and dress them and you know, change their diapers than to teach them to do all those things. And yet we're all able to make that transition, or most of us.
Yep.
But why is it harder when the kids are 16?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I think 16-year-olds, you know, can protest more, but I also think that, you know, it's partly a matter of our fear of letting go or our hesitancy to let go of our kids. And if we truly send it, when we truly teach them to be adults, they go off on their own. And all parents are ambivalent about that, and that's, you know, that's a normal, natural thing. The real question is, can we get over our ambivalence and say, okay, yeah, it feels sort of cozy for me to help my teenager with their college application and spend 4 hours sitting next to them helping them do it, but this isn't really preparing them for what comes after. This isn't really helping them grow up. And so we kind of have to resist that urge to say, well, we'll just keep them as adolescents a little bit longer because, you know, it's kind of nice having them around in some ways because, of course, the problem is, you know, like anything that you keep too long, you know, they might be nice having around at 16 or 17, but when you've got a 25-year-old sitting in your basement playing video games all day, you know, that doesn't seem so nice anymore.
We define safety and danger for young people in much broader ways today than we probably did a century ago. Do we fear the wrong things for our teenagers?
We really do. And it's partly the media, you know, that if you hear about an abduction of an adolescent, and we do hear about those, you know, that sticks in your mind. And those things, those kinds of terrible events have happened, you know, throughout history. But it used to be that if some incredibly rare event happened in some small town, you know, in northwest Arkansas, people in that area heard about it, but it wasn't something that was on cable news for 24 hours a day. And so parents get exposed to this, and they start worrying about these things, which turn out to be incredibly rare. School shootings would be another example. You know, after the Columbine shootings, I consulted with some local school districts, and they were considering putting in all sorts of, you know, metal detectors and, you know, security badges and all sorts of things, which were very expensive and would take a lot of money away from other priorities. And I asked them, you know, how often do you think, you know, what's the risk of a shooting like this happening in this school system? You know, do you think it would, if we don't do anything, would it happen once every 5 years or every 10 years? And that's kind of what they thought. And if you look at the actual how likely these things are, it's about once every 2,000 years something like that would happen in a typical school district. And we'd still want to prevent that, but in that 2,000 years, we'd lose several thousand kids to drunk driving accidents. We'd lose, you know, more than 1,000 to teenage suicide, and we'd lose, you know, tens if not hundreds of thousands to school dropout and failure and to drug abuse problems. So we worry about the extreme kinds of things, and we say, I don't want my teenager walking, you know, 2 miles home from school every day at age 13 because somebody could abduct them. But we forget about the other dangers that come with keeping them dependent for too long.
I want to talk for a minute about the influences that exist in modern teenagers' lives, because this really stunned me. Kids today spend an average of 60 hours a week interacting solely with their peers and 16 interacting with adults.
Yep, and you know, it used to be, as best as we can estimate, it used to be those numbers were almost exactly reversed, that young people used to spend most of their time interacting with adults, and not just with their parents. They would apprentice with other adults. They would work with extended family members. They would work in communities with other people. And so the result is, you know, one of my undergraduates a few years ago described it to me and in a class, and she said, you know, it's like as teenagers we all live in a bubble. And the bubble consists of, you know, the walls of our classroom, the walls of our room at home, a shopping mall, the TV, the internet, and the cell phone. And you know what? Aside from those places, that's really where we're living most of our lives, and we don't really get much contact with the larger adult world. And the problem, of course, with that is if you grow up in that bubble where peers become incredibly important, they're your main social contact in that world, they end up doing the socializing. And there are no adults to sort of pass on adult values to our young people, and they end up getting them, you know, it's the joke I make, but it's not really very funny in some ways, is we think that our kids will just pick up their socialization through the airwaves. But, you know, they end up doing it because they pick it up through the internet and through media and through what they hear on their cell phone. And it's just not what we'd like to have them learn.
Joseph Allen is professor of psychology and director of clinical training at the University of Virginia. His new book is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence, How We Can Help Our Teenagers Grow Up Before They Grow Old. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Professor of Psychology and Director of Clinical Training at the University of Virginia, Joseph Allen. His new book is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence, How We Can Help Our Teenagers Grow Up Before They Grow Old. Our telephone number to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Joe, you write in the book that there are adults who recognize that the teenagers in their lives need more adult interaction, but then they'll come to you and say, I tried, and my kids want no part of me anymore.
Right. And, you know, part of that is how we end up treating our teens, that we end up, without really thinking about it, we end up treating them not as adults, but we end up treating them as little kids in the way we talk to them. And the example that we use in the book that we've worked with a number of families on is how do you deliver criticism to your teen? And, you know, most parents, you know, if a teenager doesn't, you know, pick up something they're supposed to pick up or, you know, is late when they're supposed to be on time, you know, most parents kind of let their kids have it. They're like, where the heck have you been? You know, we've been waiting for you. This is just ridiculous. Why are you always late? You know, do you not take me seriously? You know, that sort of thing. And what we ask parents to do is to imagine if they had a boss who, when, you know, they did something wrong, criticized them in the same way. Or was always sort of saying what they could be doing differently and better and really just met them with nothing other than that. And most people are pretty clear that they would avoid that boss. Even if the boss was right, they would avoid them. What we find is that when we can help parents start to talk to their teens in ways that, you know, respect their teens' budding adulthood, that say, you know, I'm sure you were doing lots of other things, but, you know, you're being late is really causing a problem here. Can we talk about this? Let's see if we can work something else out. That learning to talk to your teens in that way, you know, your teens are still going to be impulsive. It's not going to keep them from, you know, ever being late again, but it gets a conversation going. Otherwise, what happens is you can say whatever you want as harshly as you want to most teens, but they become pretty good at tuning it out. And I've worked with teens where parents have really lit into them, and at the end I say to the teen, I pull them aside and say, you know, what's your parent just saying? They say, I have no idea. And that's what we really want to get past. If we're going to help socialize our kids, we really have to get to the point where we're talking in a way that they're actually going to listen to us.
Well, it's interesting because you write about helping them find their inner adult and helping yourself find their inner adult. But a lot of parents feel like if it's not my way or the highway, somehow they have lost the respect of their teenagers.
Right. And, you know, parents absolutely need to be in charge of a number of just, you know, core aspects of daily life and their families, and they should be in charge, you know, that they're the ones doing the work and making things go. But teens are really, you know, hardwired to seek autonomy, to try and be independent, to try and, you know, go their own way, to feel like they can have some input. And so the parents who are most effective are looking for ways to give their kids choices wherever they can. So rather than say, you know, you need to do these dishes right now. You know, what you say to the teen is, you know, you need to do these dishes at some point in the next hour, and you can choose when it's going to be, but they have to be done by 8. And you can say, or, you know, if not, then I'm going to, you know, have you do the breakfast dishes tomorrow, because that's going to just be a hassle for me. And not because I'm trying to punish you, but just because it's a big hassle. Well, most teens would far rather have that choice. And even with a consequence that goes with it, then be told what they have to do right at that instant. And so if parents can just assert control over the big issues, but give their teens some choice about the small issues and about how they manage some of those issues, it goes much better.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Joseph Allen, whose new book is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence. Let's go to Jillian in Lake Worth. Hi, Jillian.
Oh, hi. I was wondering if the author had read or heard of the book Hold On to Your Children. I don't recall who the co-authors are, but the author makes a big point about how adolescents are spending more time with their peers, less time with adults, and it's just leading to disrespect for adults and perpetual adolescenthood. And if you had any other comments.
Thanks for your call.
Sure.
Thank
you for the question. You know, I think parents do want to get their kids to be in contact with adults. The problem is we ask parents to do all of that socializing work now, and it's just too much. The teens are trying to break away from their parents and become independent. And so the amount of socializing, the amount of passing on values that parents can do by the time their teens are 16 or 17 is somewhat limited by that. So what we tell parents is don't take it on all yourself. Look for ways of recruiting other adults into your teen's life. And we give a number of suggestions. You probably have natural groups of friends that you get together with. We have a group we vacation with every summer. And one of the things we've realized is our teens are happy to talk to the other adults in the group, and they'll answer questions where we're eager to hear what their answers are, because they'll be more forthcoming with those other adults than they are with us sometimes, and they'll take in what they say. And as, you know, parents have all had the experience of repeating something over and over to their teens that doesn't seem to get through, and then somebody else mentions it to them, and they come home and repeat it as though they've heard it for the very first time. And that's frustrating to parents, but boy, we can take advantage of that. So partly we work with our friends to say, you know, don't pass up those little chances to interact with each other's children. That it used to be in our communities, we all socialized each other's children and adolescents, and that lets us hold on to them longer. That it's we're sending them into a community of adults rather than just trying to hold on to them just within our homes, which is oftentimes a losing battle with teens.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak next with Lee in Fort Worth. Hello, Lee.
Hi. I have a 13-year-old son who has been designated gifted and talented. He's also in the Duke University Talent Identification Program. But he also has attention deficit disorder, et cetera. All of that's being treated. The problem is in less than 6 months after turning 13, he went from making A's and B's to C's and D's and low D's. And I'm being told by the school that I should be able to go online and babysit him to make sure that he's turning in homework assignments on time, because turning in homework assignments late is the major cause of why his grades are so low. The question that I have is, at what point do I quit babysitting him? As much as I would love to go back to college and be his roommate and make sure he gets his term papers and things turned in time, at some point, he's going to have to learn the consequences of turning in assignments in late and what those are. And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you so much.
Thanks for your call.
Sure. It's a great question. And, you know, your question about just when do you stop having to babysit is more on target than you might even realize. That we work with parents of college students who are calling them several times a week, reminding them of papers they have due. And you know, you don't want to be in that position. And so at 13, you're asking exactly the right question. So, you know, my answer to that is that 13 is a great time to learn that if you don't do the work, things don't go well. The one thing you have to make sure of is that, in fact, something doesn't go well that your son cares about. And so, you know, one of the problems that we have, you know, across the board with teenagers is, you know, in school, they say, well, I'm doing all of this work, but what am I doing it for? I'm doing it for five letters that show up on a piece of paper every 9 weeks. You know, I don't care about that all that much. And someday this is going to have an impact on my life, but that's so far off, it's hard to imagine. So you have to have those five letters have some impact on your son's life now. And I would suggest you sit down with them, the kind of thing we suggested with parents. You make up an employment contract, and you say, you know, when I'm at work, I have certain goals I have to meet, and if I meet them, I get a bonus, and if I don't meet them, there are bad things that happen. And you set up something like that with school. And then your job is not to make sure your son gets all the homework in on time. Your job is to be their coach, to be their advocate, to help him out, to be his consultant if he needs help figuring out how to do this, and to assume that he'll learn from succeeding. But he'll also learn from failing and from not succeeding and from losing things he wants at times. And, you know, it's a great lesson to learn at 13 because the costs are really low. I work all the time with undergraduates who haven't learned that lesson. And when you're failing in a course in college that your parents are paying, you know, $20,000 or $30,000 or more to send you to, that's a much more costly lesson. So I think you're right on target to be saying, okay, 13, this is the time to say this is your responsibility, but let me help you take it over. Let me make sure you've got what you need, and let me make sure that you know what it's going to take to really make this work.
What do I do about the fact, Joe, that the stakes of failure seem to be higher at younger and younger ages, in that if that 13-year-old doesn't do well in eighth grade, then maybe he doesn't get into the right high school, and then maybe he doesn't get into the college that his parents had hoped for. It does seem like parents sometimes jump in because they're so afraid that something that seems like not a big deal now will have repercussions down the road.
Sure, and, you know, parents are really afraid of that, and kids sense it, and we work with young people, sometimes very high-achieving young people, who are just going a little bit batty because they realize in some way that everything they're doing is really geared toward what a college admissions officer is going to read some January of their senior year on a paper application or an online application that they send in. And that's both sort of boring because it doesn't seem very meaningful, but it's also incredibly high pressure. And, you know, what we know is that high school admission and college admission make some difference, but they make less difference than we think, and that if you have a motivated young person who's thoughtful and knows where they want to go and knows how to work hard and believes that they can do things on their own, they could start at a community college and head off to great things. And the flip side is, you know, Harvard and Yale and UVAs of the world have a disappointing number of students who come with all the right credentials and their parents have, you know, plowed the way ahead of them to get them to this point, but they're not really ready to take advantage of it. And so it's less a matter of wanting your child to, you know, have achieved the, you know, ideal college application than it is having them really be ready to go off to college and do things on their own. And I'd much rather see kids fail a little bit along the way and realize that failure is not the end of the world and yet it's something they want to avoid in the future, than to have had them sort of grow up in a hothouse, never really knowing how to make it on their own in the world.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Austin in Denton. Hello, Austin.
Hi. I just had a question. I know that all the talk that has gone on so far has been for parents, but if I feel like, because I'm a 21-year-old at the University of North Texas, and everything that you guys talked about as far as like being in a bubble inside a classroom and not really getting out there and seeing what the real world is for yourself, just kind of doing what you've been told, and then especially the hanging out with your peers for 80% of the time. So what advice would you have for a student or for the teenager himself that maybe he could do things on his own to get himself out of the bubble and kind of start working towards becoming an adult? Because I feel like I'm in those shoes. Like I just now realized that I need to start doing it myself. And for my first semester of college, my parents paid for it. And then my first couple semesters, and then at one semester I ended up making an F. And I started paying for my own college at that point because my mom was telling me that if I'm going to bring home grades like that, she's not going to support my education, which makes sense to me. So ever since that point, I've kind of started growing. But what else can someone, a teenager, do to get himself out of that bubble?
Yeah, thanks
for
calling.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks.
Great question, Austin. You know, I hope that the previous caller who was worried about her 13-year-old not doing well, you know, is still online to kind of hear that, because you learned that lesson, you know, with college tuition in a hard way that it would be nice if some other kids could learn at a younger age. But, you know, what we tell, you know, one of the things we tell parents that I can tell you as a 21-year-old that you can apply just as well, and I really applaud you for kind of being thinking about these issues, is, you know, volunteer. And we tell this to parents, get your young person out doing something in the real world where you're really making a difference to other people. You, at 21, you may not be able to go, you know, land a job, you know, part-time in college that's going to be very meaningful. That can be really difficult. But there are tons of places that would love to have you as a volunteer where you can really make a difference in people's lives. And you, in essence, begin to see, and what we tell parents is that teenagers, in essence, begin to see first that, okay, they can have a role in the adult world, that they are really of value to somebody else, that there is meaning in what they're doing. And I've worked with a number of young people who volunteered, and that's shaped what they've done. I, you know, 30 years ago, I, in college, volunteered to work on a hotline and did it sort of on a whim. A roommate was volunteering and asked me if I'd join him, and that ended up directing my career from that point on in a way that, you know, classes probably never would have. It's something that's really helpful. What we tell parents is it's hard sometimes to get your young person to volunteer, and parents kind of think, really, is this really worth it? We worked with one family that had a 15-year-old boy who was really reluctant about this whole volunteering idea, and the parents finally sort of went through a bunch of options with him that they looked at, and they kind of grudgingly, the child agreed, okay, I'll work at this day camp, a summer camp for kids with disabilities, because at least it's outdoors, and I like that, and if I do that for 2 or 3 weeks, will you guys get off my back? And so they said, sure. The first day came, and the kid was like, why did I agree to this? This is stupid. I don't want to do this, and he was practically in tears going there. The parents picked him up at the end of the day. First thing out of his mouth was to his mother was, you know, Mom, you know, it's a good thing I was there. Like, they needed so much help that if I hadn't been there, I don't know what would have happened. Like, there was this kid in a wheelchair, and all of the activities were all on these paths that weren't paved. And if I hadn't been there to push him, I don't think he would have made it to any of his activities. And this young man was so charged up. You know, he probably did more chores that summer at this camp than he'd done, you know, his entire life. But he finally had a place where he was doing something that was meaningful to someone else. And it's a good thing I was there experience that, you know, people can really resonate with, and that teens, you know, if we want to build their self-esteem, this is one of the ways we can really let them know they are of value to someone, is let them actually do things that are really valuable to other people. So I think, you know, getting out there volunteering, finding a place in the world where you can start to make your mark, even if it's not in a big way, it takes you out of the bubble and it says, okay, I'm doing this work in college, I'm filling out these multiple choice answer sheets, but I'm doing it because I want to get to do this other kind of work at a higher level in the future.
Joseph Allen is my guest. His new book is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence, How We Can Help Our Teenagers Grow Up Before They Grow Old. You can get online to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a new 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/plano-cfp.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Joseph Allen, professor of psychology and director of clinical training at the University of Virginia. His new book is called Escaping the Endless Adolescence, How We Can Help Our Teenagers Grow Up Before They Grow Old. An email here from Mike asks, what's the relationship between the rise of child-centric families and extended adolescence? I played YMCA football as a kid, but it wasn't the center of my parents' world. My goddaughter's prom weekend was a far more involved and expensive experience than my wedding.
Yeah, that is striking, and you know, I don't think that's an unusual experience. We've changed how parents think about raising children. Raising children used to be one thing parents did while they tried to sort of survive as a family and survive on their own. And now, partly because parents are having children at older ages when they're more settled, partly because they're having smaller families, partly because they're a bit more affluent, children have become the center of parents' lives. And, you know, it's in helping parents get out of this way of thinking, it's really a mindset that we have to get people to challenge. We tell parents, you know, you're trying to raise your child to be an adult, but if all they see adulthood as being about is helping raise somebody else, if there's no actual living as an adult where you go off and live your own life and let your kids live their life, that's not a very good model for them. And so, you know, we want our children to want to grow up to be adults. We want to teach them that adulthood is fun and that it's not just about being burdened by, you know, planning your daughter's, you know, junior prom. and that's a hard message to get across, because parents have, you know, grown up for years thinking about doing everything they possibly can for their parents, and it's a very strong instinct. It's, you know, it's a natural instinct that we used to be kept in check because we didn't have the resources and the time to devote our whole lives to our kids. You know, in some ways, we were better off when it was kept in check because then young people had to contribute. We needed their efforts. You know, a few generations back, young people, teenagers, contributed 30% of a family's income, and now most, you know, if they work, the income pretty much all goes to their discretionary spending. And parents are saying, yeah, you spend that on yourself. But, you know, use that for your extras, as opposed to help out the family a bit.
Let's go next on the line to Mary in Dallas. Hello, Mary. Hi, Mary. Are you with us? Okay. We will move on and instead go to Summer in Irving. Hi, Summer.
Yes. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure. Welcome.
I was calling because I volunteer. I'm a child of a single-parent family. My mom raised two teenagers as a single mom, and I spend a lot of my volunteer time at church with specifically single-parent kids, and that ranges in age from age 5 to age 18. And a lot of times, teenagers of single-parent families are forced to grow up far faster than the average teen, either of today or yesteryear. But I was wondering if you could speak to the differences, because they're forced to grow up so fast, versus other teenagers who have it pretty easy.
Thanks for your call.
Sure, and kids in single-parent families do have to grow up faster. And, you know, we worry about them, and there are some ways in which they suffer for that. There are other ways, though, in which that added responsibility and that added sense of you know, being the person who's going to really take care of yourself rather than counting on somebody else to do it can be immensely helpful in life. The problem we're seeing is that Even single-parent families today often end up being more child-centered than makes sense. And so we've worked with single-parent families where the mother was struggling to just make the rent payment each month and working a second job, you know, to, you know, just cover the basics in life. And oftentimes their children were working too, but they were pulling down $200 or $300 a month that went to just discretionary spending. And so we have mothers who are, you know, barely able to put food on the table, and kids who have, you know, kids are walking around with iPhones and nice leather jackets and, you know, nice clothes and stereos and such. And we ask the parents, well, what's going on here? And they're like, you know, I had it rough as a kid. I don't want my teenager to have to experience that. And so even those parents are putting themselves aside to such an extent that their teenagers are getting just a terribly unrealistic view of the world. And, you know, it's not that we want parents to be selfish, but it's that we want parents to help teach their teens that the teens are not the center of the world and that other people need their help and other people need their effort, and that if you're 15 and, you know, you're not doing anything except, you know, draining your parents, you know, time and energy and resources, then it's really kind of hard to feel good about yourself in terms of self-esteem. So some kids in single-parent families, you know, get more than enough responsibility. Some kids are living in terrible conditions where, you know, they don't have it easy, and that's not who we're really, you know, directing our thinking toward. But some actually are suffering from this exact same problem that we've been describing, in spite of the fact that you'd think, well, their parents have enough hardship that the hardship would be shared and the kids would be contributing too, but they just aren't.
We have an email here from Carrie in Richardson who asks, what recommendations do you have for the adults who will have to work with them? Sometimes I find myself resenting these kids because their parents bought them nicer cars than I drive.
Right, right. You know, they have nicer cars, and they oftentimes are kids who've been given just activities that are just nothing but tailored for them. I empathize with that problem. I interviewed a UVA undergraduate a couple of years back for a job working with me, and this young man was very qualified and was pretty good, you know, handling himself during the interview. But at the end, they asked if he had any questions. And he said, you know, well, this all sounds good and everything, but as you've described the job, I have a feeling that, like, parts of it could be a little bit boring at times. And I really don't want to be in a job where I'm ever going to have to be bored. And, you know, I know what adolescents are going through, and I would be willing to wager that this young man had probably had activities provided to him that weren't boring, that were stimulating and enriching his whole life. And so, you know, I understood where he was coming from, but he didn't get the job. So you know, what I say to adults working with young people like this, though, in general, is we end up having to do some of the socializing that we wish had been done at 15 and 16, and it's now done in the 20s and, you know, even in the 30s at some point. It's not such a terrible thing. I think, you know, young people used to work as apprentices in their teenage years and probably learn a lot of this, you know, at that point from the people that were their masters. Well, you know, in some sense, we're still apprenticing youth. They're just in their 20s now. And we're going to roll our eyes, but if nobody has taught them the basics of how do you get along and how do you do things that are sometimes boring, you know, I worked with a person running a radio station who said that, you know, young people came in to work there who didn't know how to push a broom. And, you know, he said, should I show them? And the answer was, you know, we roll our eyes, but yes, somebody does need to show them, and they may be 5 or 10 years late with this, but better late than never in this case.
Let's go next on the phones to Ulyss and speak with Drannon. Hi, Drannon.
Hi. Thanks for calling, or thanks for taking my call,
sure.
I didn't say. my question is kind of like the young man's question from Denton. I'm 24. I kind of feel as if I'm in a state of arrested development myself. My parents divorced at a young age. I had a somewhat tumultuous youth, and I feel like I'm just now coming out of it. Do you have any advice for people in their young to mid-20s who may have made some mistakes in their past and are trying to grow up and move past them? Any good advice for us?
Sure. I mean, good for you for recognizing that and for really trying to move past it. You know, your situation is such that, you know, people have described it as the quarter-life crisis. You know, you get to 25 and you feel like, I don't have a clue where I'm going in my life. I don't even feel terribly prepared. You know, the single best piece of advice that I think we can give to young people in your situation is pick something that seems like it's, you know, closest to what your interests are and throw yourself into it. And, you know, what you don't want to do is, and you don't want to do this at 16, you don't want to hang back saying, well, this is kind of interesting, but I might want to hold out because I might find something else that's more interesting. You know, we learn by doing, and we learn by making mistakes. And if you pick a job and you throw yourself into it for a year and you hate it, you'll learn a huge amount from that. And you may learn more from that than if you found something easier in the first instance. So throw yourself into something, you know, some sort of job, some sort of work, and, you know, recognize that you may start at the bottom, that it may not be very interesting, and that boredom and mistakes and setbacks not only are part of life, but we can really learn a huge amount from them. And so, you know, we teach our young people to be afraid to fail. That one of the dangers of being a parent of a 13-year-old, where you make sure they get all their homework in on time, they never get the experience of sometimes seeing setbacks and then getting through that. And the attitude we're trying to sort of promote in parents and in young people is that failure's okay, mistakes are okay. They can be some of the places where you have your greatest, you know, instances of learning. And so jump into something. Don't be afraid to let whatever happen following that would be my suggestion.
Let's speak next with Eddie in Mansfield. Hello, Eddie.
Hello. This is Eddie Chapman.
Go right ahead.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess the speaker must be clairvoyant. Sure enough, that's along the lines of my question, which is, you know, at 13, how do you teach them to manage disappointment in a way that helps them as they get to be adults?
Good question. You know, I think the first and the biggest and the most important step as parents is we have to be willing to let our kids experience disappointment. I had the experience of talking with a group of my undergraduates a couple of years back, some of my best graduating seniors at UVA, and I asked them, what were the experiences that really made you feel like you were starting to grow up and become an adult? And as I went around the room, I was shocked because they all had pretty much the same answer, which is they all described places where they'd made mistakes, where there'd been an accident, where they'd screwed something up, something had gone wrong, but then they'd fixed it on their own. So one young woman described getting confused about her checking account, not keeping good track of it, and bouncing checks all over town. And then having to go around from merchant to merchant and straighten it out. And she said, you know, it was hard, and it was a pain, and it was kind of scary at first. But then I realized I could do this, and I realized I'm not going to bounce another check again. I've certainly learned my lesson about that. But I also realized, okay, I can handle the adult world. I can make mistakes, and it's not the end of the world, and I do have to dig myself out of it. But that's something I'm willing to do. And I think starting at 13, we can teach our young people to do that. So we worked with one parent of a young lady who was, I think, 13 or 14, and came into her parents' room crying one Sunday night saying, you know, I've just gotten so far behind on all my work. You know, I've got, you know, history to do and algebra and French, and I can't possibly get it all done for the next 2 days. What I have to do, what can I do? And the parents basically said, well, you know, you need to prioritize, and you may not get it all done, and that's going to be a problem, but you know, pick the thing that you think is most important and do that first. She said, well, no, you know, you got to tell me what I, you know, help me out of this. It's your job to help me get out of this problem. And we have to realize as parents, it's not our job to help our teens get out of their problems. It's our job to give them good guidance, but to let them have the experience of struggling with their problems and their failures on their own. It used to happen naturally. Hardship made it something that happened just without any thought, and we all benefited from it. And now we've gotten to the point where we've taken a lot of that away from our teens, and we don't just realize just how much they benefit from the struggle.
Joe, how often do parents realize that they are inadvertently contributing to the problem?
You know, I think in a subtle way, parents, you know, most parents know that they are. They have a sense of, you know, I'm just doing too much here. You know, I shouldn't feel like I'm having to live my life and my teenager's life, because that's one too many lives to be trying to keep responsibility for. They just don't know what to do about it. They're so paralyzed by the fear of their kids having a setback or a failure, not realizing how much their kids can benefit from some of those failures, that they don't know what to do. And what we tell those parents is, nobody wants their kids to fail, but everybody's going to make mistakes in life. Do you want your young person to do it at 13, or do you want them to do it at 25? And the consequences are way less at 13, and the chance to learn from it and to get help from your parents afterwards is way greater at that age. And that's one of the ways we help parents start to get out of this mindset.
And the last thing I want to ask you in the 30 seconds or so we have left, what are the signs parents can use to assess whether their kids' lives are